And did you do any work while you were living in
Europe? No, you see, we live in a very peculiar period. In fact, I got four educations.
Really?
This one weren't complete. In Eastern Europe particularly, of course, big cities and small towns, you start out a child when he's 5 years old. He goes to cheder. Mm-hmm. This particular cheder is, you start with the alphabet, and you go through as far as the old pattern took, the five books. Until then, you get only a religious education. Also, there is a teacher of calligraphy, used to teach you how to write Yiddish, or Hebrew, rather. Mm-hmm. And that was the only thing that was secular, this particular teacher. Otherwise, the so-called Melamed or Rabbi, mm-hmm. he did everything. We were sitting on a long bench, on a long table, and benches at both sides. And anyone who didn't pay any attention, you can pity him. He had a
yardstick or something? A switch?
No, a seven tail, a cat.
Oh, a cat of seven tails.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And as children, our fantasy, we hope that he fall asleep with a long beard. Uh-huh. So if it get glue in Louis' beard to the table, that how much we were in love with him. That was the first.
Really?
And when you come into the cheder, the first thing, your mother or your father comes along with you, and they throw down a coin, and they tell you that an angel, when you start, that an angel from heaven,
yeah,
threw that coin down.
Ah.
Being that particular age, of course, you can be not too selective who, what, and when, so you accept it, but later on you find out, sure enough. That was the first cheder. I think you go there for about 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to the second. The second already, you get a secular. It's everything included religious, but you go from Chumash, at the Pentateuch, to Tanakh, that's the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
From there, it's very hard. I mean, for a child of 8, 9 years old, because the language in the Tanakh, in the prophets, it's very unlike than the Pentateuch, because it's more complicated and it's really a highly literary Hebrew.
I see.
You got to know that language very well, but mm-hmm. you get through somehow,
mm-hmm.
one way or another. But they also did teach us Russian,
oh,
because the Russian was still there.
And then you continued. Did you go to school the whole time that you were that you lived there, or did you work?
Towards the end, I did work. You see, since we have a big textile industry, there was quite a few subcontractors.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you want to be a manufacturer, but you don't have the tools, you don't have the machinery,
mm-hmm.
and all the machinery we brought in from England, most of it, because England was a pioneer in textiles. Particularly Manchester and Leeds.
Mm-hmm.
They brought it in. It was a beginning, it was by hand. But later on, electricity came in 1909, 1910. They were all worked. And this consisted of the whole process of producing this year textile consisted of four stages. First, you take the burlap, all kinds of
mm-hmm.
peasant old clothes.
What languages are spoken in your home in Europe?
Yiddish.
Yiddish. And then we talked about your schooling. You went to this secular school after the cheder.
It's partially secular.
Partially secular. Mm-hmm. And for how many years?
We have to be accurate.
Yeah.
It probably would be about 4 years, I would say.
And there you were. You had your Jewish training in addition, your religious training in addition.
Yeah, I mean, you get a smattering of a little more of the past, the Tanakh. You start going into being prepared for the Mishneh, which is the commentary on the Talmud. And then the war breaker.
And And do you remember your synagogue, what the synagogue was like?
Yes, very well, very clearly. The most amazing thing in our city, there were a huge synagogue, which was with a big dome. By the way, Hitler burned 1,500 Jews in that synagogue, Jewish, everything included. That synagogue was the show place for the simple reason that used to bring canners, well-known canners from all over. And you had to buy a ticket before Friday, prepare.
Oh, for each week?
No. Oh. If that particular, they had a permanent canner.
I see.
But they had to, this was Marcella Rosenblatt or Hirschman or Kvartin or Serrata, well, the well-known canners of that particular time. And it was jam-packed, you can never get in there. During the week, anyone could come in, but there were, I don't know, I really, it was kept up, but it was kept up beautifully. And around that particular, it was like a circle, it was in the center, around that, there were many, many Bate Medroshim. A Beis Medrash is also a synagogue, but it's a much smaller group.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you see?
You mean this was like the center? Yeah.
But in Iran, they also had the Bet Din. You see, Bialystok did not have a well-known rabbi died. There was anyone who's acquainted with the Zionist movement, he was among the firstborn. His name was Shmuel Molliver. He came and he was in Bialystok for a good length of time and he died. And since then, tradition added that they did not want to replace someone lesser than he, who was a great, great man, a great Persian scholar. So they maintain a Beth Din, which consists of a few. They're all ordained rabbis, but none of them. There was one chief rabbi, but he did not have the authority that a real. But they also had a koshal. Koshal was mainly for the more secular and assimilated Jews in the town, because there was quite a few assimilationists, particularly in the upper brackets, very well-to-do manufacturers who did not want to mix with oil for oil, and particularly this year, Koshul, or I might as well compare it to a temple or conservative, had the bima connected with the Ohr Kodesh, which according to Orthodox rule or ritual, whatever you want to have it, are not allowed. This was one thing.
Secondly,
they had one of the finest scanners and a choir of 24 with an excellent, excellent conductor, a fellow by the name of Berman. So you could go in there, but when it came to the high holidays or anything, it was only for memberships only. Then they had a group of, it's called among the Hasidim, it's called, instead of calling it a Bet Medrash or a synagogue, it's called a Shtibl. I don't know where it derives from. There were quite a few Hasidim.
Oh.
See, mainly we were Mishnagdim. We were Ashkenazi Mishnagdim. But there were here and there Hasidim, and they stayed for themselves. I mean, they were in the mainstream of life, but nevertheless, they used to come much, much later after services. They took the time, and you know the whole concept of Hasidism with the joy, to serve the Lord, the joy.
Yeah.
A lot of dancing going on.
Yeah.
In fact, Simchas Torah was the place to go, because first of all, it was the only time you could drink all you want without having a guilt feeling. So,
didn't want it. Your whole life was
just involved with our home.
Mm-hmm. And now we're coming to the Zionist organization. Did you attend any of the?
Quite a few. They had what I call Bet Han, a building of their own with a theater, little theater, stage, all equipment for many rooms for meetings, and there was also a big labor movement. As a rule, in Eastern European towns, you did not have that, but since Bialystok was an industrial center, they did have a big labor movement. Also, besides having textiles, they also had tanneries.
Oh, tanneries also.
Yeah, but they were located on the outskirts of town because of the horrible smell. Mm-hmm.
And did you participate in these movements when you were there? Were you
participate at my age? I was rather a curious onlooker more than anything else because I could not differentiate.
And how about your father? Was he?
Yes, but my father was a. He was interested mainly. He had a fairly good voice, but he was a so-called amateur canner, as a hobby, and he liked that. And I got from him, I got a tremendous love for the theater, which is carried up till this day, telling us stories about how it came about, the Jewish theater, the so-called of the group called the Brother Singer, which were the forerunners of Goldfaden, who was the father of the Jewish theater. But Jewish theater was forbidden by the Tsarist government.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. I don't know which one of the Alexanders, the second or the first, did not, but as Jewish people always find a way, they pretended they were playing in German, but it wasn't very successful. Quite a few performances were giving in private houses, but you always had to be on the lookout that some provocateur or police shouldn't find out, and they would arrest everybody. I witnessed quite a few performances like that. But after the entrance of the German army into Bialystok, we were completely freed. As kids, with a curiosity, I roamed around the city because you were in between changing powers. The Russians were at Kazhonny Gymnasium. Kazhonny in Russian means government. Mm-hmm. There were only 1% Jews there. You had to be brilliant or have a lot of pull in order to get in there. And above all, you had to be rich. There were a lot of private gymnasiums and private schools, but they did not have you could not get if you want to become a lawyer or a doctor, mm-hmm. they weren't recognized. They were, but with a lot of reservations, you know, they did not encourage. But nevertheless, we have managed. I started reading a newspaper when I was 5 years old, of course, a Yiddish newspaper. Mm-hmm. And to me, Yiddish is, I'm in love with that. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that, I mean, it's dying out, no question about it. It lasted almost 800-900 years, if you know the history of the Yiddish language. And I was brought up, actually, of course, we did read Russian classics, like, I knew enough Russian to read like Lermontov, Gogol, Pushkin, they were the classicists, mm-hmm. or Krylov. Krylov was the creator of fables, like La Fontaine, or quite a few. But our hearts were in Yiddish literature. The story of Yiddish literature begins around 1880. There were a group of writers, quite a few, especially Mendel Mechashvorn, who is the father of Yiddish literature. They all started to write, quite a few of them started to write in Russian or Hebrew. But the audience was so small because the great mass of people were not educated. They could read Yiddish. Mm-hmm. So they compromised, and most of them started to write in Yiddish. And they created one of the finest literatures. I mean, the outside world knows very little about it. There's one book which I recommend. I mean, if you're interested mm-hmm. enough by Irving Howe, who is a professor of English at Hunters, and Eliezer Greenberg. It's called Yiddish.
Yiddish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The preface is worth the book. It's 80 pages. Then they give you samples of the. They give you samples of the different type of writers. You had excellent poets, You had excellent novelists. Of course, there were writers that appealed to so-called the quite a few maids or servants, positions you couldn't get. You couldn't. They put blocks everywhere, any way possible. I don't know whether you ever read The Fixer by Melamed, which he does not. It's not a good novel, but he did not bring in certain things. To me, I was eager, which I like Melamed, but I was eager, but he doesn't bring that element in at all. Of course, he deals only with one particular person, you see. But coming back to the old thing, the cultural life, there were meetings, lectures, whatever. It was a big city. Sholem Aleichem was in our city in 1909, and he visited the home for the aged. So when he came back, he wrote for one of the outstanding papers in Warsaw. One was called The Eind, Today, and The Moment, The Moment. Mm-hmm. And in one of his articles he said, the bedsheets in the Meshevskanim in Bialystok looked like the map of Europe. And there was also, in our city, was the founder of Esperanto, Vendra. Bima, the Hebrew theater, which is in Israel today, was founded in Bialystok by two brothers, Benjamin and Nahum Tzemach. One was a schoolmate of my brother. I don't remember which one. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, from then on, they went to Moscow, and from Moscow they came back to Israel.
And when at this period of your life, what did you think of America? What were your thoughts?
I didn't have the slightest conception, or I didn't even think of going to America, but something has happened. Mm-hmm. My uncle, who lived here since the 1880s, and he didn't see his family for that long of a period, decided to take a trip right after the First World War was over. And he was the first one to come to Bialystok from the United States. This is the only time I came in contact with someone who was from America. Mm-hmm. Although we did have a stationary circus during the winter, and they had quite a few Negroes in it. And we looked at these Negroes and we said, amazing, they must have put shoe polish on their faces.
We've never seen
him before. And when he came, that's the only time we started. And of course, we read about America. That, we used to see American movies.
Uh-huh.
Quite a few. Of course, the main supply of movies in those particular days were France and Sweden. But then later on, America started to come in with certain movies, like cowboy movies and. Some others. There's an American actress of that time who was very popular by the name of Fern Andra, A-N-D-R-A, Fern Andra. And but gradually we get to know, then quite a few Jewish actors came. It was right after the war. And around 1919 we started to think of my uncle made the arrangements, but it took us almost 2 years until the
Did your whole family? Did your family come together?
No, my brother came first, but it was only a year, and we followed him.
Mm-hmm. And was there any particular reason why you picked the United States rather than?
Due to my uncle.
Mm-hmm. And then your parents came also?
Oh, yes.
And when you came to the United States, did you have a definite destination?
I was in love with the theater. It's almost an obsession. But under the circumstances, I came, first of all, I was terribly disillusioned with Pittsburgh. Going through, Bialystok was no architectural beauty, believe you me. But it had a certain, like all European bigger cities, they tried to fashion it after Paris in a small way. In fact, is you see the fact remains when during the Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon's army went through Bialystok, and by all indications, they must have stayed a good while, because in the language, we took in so many French words, like for instance, étage, E-T-A-G-E, mm-hmm. means a floor. Mm-hmm. There are other names for étage in Yiddish, a gong, a stock. Quite a few. Of course, it all depends from what region you come. But in Bialystok it was étage, or meuble, spells M-E-U-B-L-E, is a French word. Etagerie, which is a little shelf. There's so many. If any researcher in the Yiddish language wants to find the source where it was due to the French army passing by, and I suppose they did leave an impression there. A good impression. And
well, how did you finally arrive?
We started out in late December 1920.
And do you remember how you traveled?
Oh, definitely. We went to, first of all, we went to Berlin. Mm-hmm. We stayed there a while. Of course, first you got to go there. To Warsaw first, because mm-hmm. you had to see the American consul to approve your visa and your passport and that everything that you have your fare to get over and all the so-called affidavit that guarantees that you will not fall task on the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You had a guarantee that in case of can't get a job or anything, that you will not apply for any assistance or anything. So from there we went to Berlin. And from Berlin we went to Rotterdam, which is the port.
Mm-hmm. Did you travel all by rail?
All on the march, all by rail.
And you took the ship from?
We stayed there a while. The reason I can't recall why we stayed there, it was a bitter cold winter. It was in February. And in Europe, February is pretty rough. We surely thought that if we would come to Holland, the weather would change.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Bialystok, we had it as low as 20, 30 below zero.
Oh.
It was customary to put in double windows for the winter.
For the cold.
And put in wool and seal everything up.
Mm-hmm.
But when we came to Holland, we were there a while. And finally, we got a boat. The name of the boat was New Amsterdam.
Oh, still one running today.
It's another one. If this tub must be out of existence by 50 years. It was a very poor boat. It took us 10 long days to get here. And it was the height of the immigration because the quota system was going into effect, and every port in the United States was terrifically busy, like the Kennedy Airport today in New York. So they turned us back and told us to go to Boston, and many others went to Baltimore.
Oh, I see.
And we stayed in.
Did you come into that
through Boston. We landed in Boston.
And then, was your uncle in Pittsburgh? Is that?
Yes, indeed.
Did anybody meet you in Boston?
In Boston, nobody, but. We took a trip, it's a long trip, it's almost a 24-hour trip under Pinelli at that time, and we finally arrived in Pittsburgh in February. And
did somebody meet you?
The whole family, everybody was here, because I was shocked and amazed at the weather. Everybody came in their short sleeves. It was an exceptionally balmy day, and it impressed me greatly, because we weren't accustomed to this type of weather, because mm-hmm. once Eastern European gets winter, it stays from Sukkot till Pesach.
There's no let up.
No let up.
Mm-hmm. And so who was included in your welcoming committee? Was that your
whole family and his children?
Mm-hmm. They all came to the station to meet you.
Very much so.
And what was your first impression of the United States when you got here?
I started loving it immediately, although I was highly disappointed with Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, the freedom of movement, the freedom of not feeling that you're not a second-rate citizen, a third-rate citizen, mm-hmm. you don't exist, in fact, mm-hmm. it impressed me greatly. And I hugged it, and immediately I got to it. And that's a new odyssey begins with looking for work. Of course.
Did you bring remember objects or papers with you? Anything of from your home?
Mainly a few photographs, but we did not carry any. Like the old-time immigrants said, we were more enlightened. First of all, mainly we came from a big city, mm-hmm. and we knew that you don't have to carry all those. You used to carry the pots and pans and pillows and stuff, which mm-hmm. was that particularly available here. So we carried hardly our own clothes and the immediate things that we had to
like
use.
Like papers or things of any, did you bring any books or papers of anything?
Not necessarily. I gave away my books and my brother gave away his books to our friends.
I see.
A book is was greatly appreciated. Contrary to here, I came with the impression that books are, it reminds me of a story again. The fellow in the bookstore in New York, I kept my Jewish name Abraham. Of course, nowadays it's no asset, but I'm proud of it.
And do you remember your first day in Pittsburgh, what you did the first day that you were here?
I was very tired. I remember one thing, I had a sore throat, so they put me to bed. But I recuperated very quickly due to my anxiety and desire to see what America looks like. So it must have been a certain amount of curiosity that did away with the sore throat.
Desire.
Yeah, that's right.
Was there anything about life in the United States that disappointed you during your first 5 years here?
No, I can't say honestly. Of course, the only thing is that I wanted an education. I did come a little too late for it because I had to go to work immediately because the chances of my father getting a job was very slender.
Mm-hmm. And was there any point during that 5 years when you felt that you were treated unjustly because you were an immigrant?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Never came that across.
Mm-hmm. And after living here for 5 years, did you feel that you had accomplished or would eventually accomplish your goal?
Here is a question which you can debate it. Probably it was due to my own fault. I did go through night high school, but I was mainly self-taught. Mm-hmm. Since having that background, the cultural background from my native town, the right away, of course, I learned English very fast with the help of a dictionary. At that time was Alexander Arkavy's dictionary was very popular, and by starting just to read it, and then a word I didn't know, I looked up in the dictionary, and I started, of course, my interest in the theater did not fade at all. The first movie, my cousin was here previously, the first movie he took me to was Today by the Nixon. There's a theater, the same theater, of course, it was remodeled today. It was called the Sam Schubert. The Sam Schubert Theater is named after one of the Schuberts who was killed in a train accident many years ago, and they named it the Sam Schubert.
Oh, I see, here in
Pittsburgh,
where the
Nixon
is
today. Mm-hmm. But the name was changed many times afterwards. Mm-hmm. The first movie I saw was Griffith's Way Down East. Since it was a silent, I didn't have any trouble understanding it at all. And I was immensely impressed with that. Mm-hmm. The Gish sisters were in it, and quite a few other very prominent playing the part, and I was greatly impressed with that. Mm-hmm. And gradually I got into the so-called cultural mainstream, if you want to call it. And of course, there were financial problems, but not too much. We managed somehow. We come from a family where we're very economical, and one thing I do lack is that dreaming. I don't dream. I'm very realistic to the extent this is it. I was never pampered. I know you face realities, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So the things that material comforts that I lacked, I made up by going to theaters 2 and 3 times a week, which compensated, reading quite a bit, going to concerts and things like that, which, I mean, probably to the average person wouldn't appeal as much, but to me it was
very important part of your
life. Yeah, a very important part.
And where was your first home in this area?
On Logan Street.